gotta be Post Corbin. Hey, you, hey, you, hey, you, hey, we gotta be Post Corbin. Yeah, 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 we gotta be Post Corbin. We gotta be Post Corbin.
You're listening to KWMR at FM 50.5 in Point Reyes Station and FM 89.9 in Bolinas. And we're streaming live at KWMR.org. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, where we explore the ways in which we can and must power down in a new era, no longer exploiting our fellow humans and ecosystems.
We believe in building up our community resilience, expecting further economic collapse in the face of abrupt climate change, the end of cheap oil, the depletion of our natural resources, and a possible mass extinction on our planet. I'm Bing Gong.
And I'm Ernie Steffen, and today we're talking about the world of sound, like ocean noise, pollution, and the impacts on marine life.
Our guest today is San Geronimo Valley resident Michael Stocker. Michael Stocker is a modern-day Renaissance man. He has many facets. He is an acoustician and a naturalist by trade and a musician by avocation. He has written and spoken about bioacoustics since 1992, presenting in national and regional hearings, national and international television, radio, and news publications, in museums, schools, and universities. His understanding of both physics and biology has proven invaluable in court testimony and legal briefs defending the environment against the dangers of human-generated noise in the sea. Welcome back to Post Carbon, Michael.
Hey, thank you, Dan, Bernie. Really great to be on board again.
Yeah, well, we're delighted to have you as a special guest for the whole hour. Let's start off. You and Eleanor and a couple of other West Marin folks joined Michael in his eighth, I guess, whale-watching tour to Baja, California last week. Michael, why don't you start about why you organize these trips? Why do you do them?
Oh, well, aside from it's exceedingly fantastic to be able to frolic with whales in their own habitat, I was asked quite a number of years ago, actually 2004, I was a science advisor for a nonprofit, and they were taking groups down there, and I intersected with them and really enjoyed the trip, and I did that with their organization. And then when I started Ocean Conservation Research, I had so much fun that I decided to continue to do the trips. We do it every March, and it's a great time of year when the Pacific Eastern Pacific gray whales breed and give birth down in the lagoons of Baja California. And there's a lot of whales down there. We go near the end of the season when mostly the lagoon is populated by mothers and their babies, and their mothers are teaching their babies how to swim and how to dive and how to forage for food and what have you. And so, like any nursery, the mothers and the babies are together, and also like any nursery, the mothers and babies play, and they like playing with people a little bit. So we get an opportunity to play with the whale.
Yeah, I was on that tour, as well as my wife, Eleanor Despina, and two folks from Inverness, Maureen Cornelia and Peter Sharamata. And we just had a wonderful time. We were down there for 8 days. We started out flying down to Loreto, which is about 400 miles south of the border. And then we drove in vans up the north along the Bay of Cortez. And then we traveled west over to the Pacific side to the San Ignacio Lagoon. That's where we spent 2.5 days. Out in these small boats they call pangas, and the whales would just come right up to the boat, and we could pet them, and a couple people actually reached down and kissed them.
How did it make you feel to be this close to these large, wonderful creatures?
Oh, it was just a one-in-a-lifetime experience. These creatures are 45 feet long, the mothers anyway, and weigh 45 tons. So, and then the calves, of course, are smaller. But I've never had anything, you know, it was quite thrilling and awesome.
Well, it's interesting, Michael, you talk about them having curiosity about humans. How there do they make sure that we humans don't sort of take advantage of them in this vulnerable situation of having their babies in a nursery?
Well, you know, we've changed our policies around these whales in the past 50 years. They were hunted all the way up to 1948, when by dint of hunting, their population was reduced to about 2,000 animals total. They were discovered in these lagoons by Scammon, I forget his first name, probably William or Robert or Richard, one of those kind of 19th century first names, and he was an interesting man. He was I guess as close to a biologist as well as a whale hunter as possible. He ended up doing a lot of dissection on these animals and a lot of natural history, but what he had discovered is these breeding lagoons, and found that the babies, if you ended up killing the babies, the mothers would come around and try to attack the boats. And this is something that's kind of unique to the gray whales and the sperm whales, because of their natural history and they're not really built for speed, but they'll actually set on their aggressors. So when the mothers would come around trying to figure out what's happened to their babies, then they would attack the mothers as well. And because they were so aggressive in defending their lives and their babies, these animals were known as devilfish. And look, one out of every four whalers was maimed or killed in this particular fishery, and so they were known to be mean. So when they stopped whaling in 1948 because it was not financially feasible anymore, the populations began recovering, and as it turned out, in 1972, a fisherman from the Hilo down there, Pachico Mayoral, was out of the water, and this large whale started kind of toying with his boat. And he said he was terrified because he was afraid this animal was going to gobble the boat up or sink him or what have you. But for a couple of hours, this animal was toying with the boat, and at one point in time, Pachico reached out and touched this animal and realized it was safe. And that was kind of the gateway. Increasingly after that, for the next few years, these whales were engaging. Now, mind you, this engagement was within the living memory of these animals being slaughtered by humans.
Wow, yeah.
So it says a lot about if they have long-term memory, which, you know, it's hard to say because you really can't ask them, but if they do have long-term memory, they had learned how to forgive humans pretty fast.
Boy, that's pretty amazing, this idea of forgiveness of the whales. And, boy, we could all understand why they would be fearful of humans based on that horrible past. You said that happened mostly as an economic situation, not as a result of political will to say this is ridiculous that we're slaughtering these mammals.
Well, you know, the whaling industry was still around quite healthily, if you will, or unhealthily, all the way to 1984, when finally there was an international moratorium put on whaling in general. But prior to that time, you know, they were still, I don't know when the last whale was processed in there was Richmond Whaling Station, but it wasn't too long ago. You know, it was within, you know, I remember in the early 70s where the first Songs of the Humpback Whale was released. Roger Payne had recorded these songs, and it was the first album that was a gold album that was made by animals. But it ended up titillating everybody's curiosity about these really giant animals that had very complex songs, and that was really where the anti-whaling movement began. But it took years. I mean, literally, as late as 1984, there was still sanctioned whaling. And finally, the International Whaling Commission shut it down, and now the only rogue nations who are whaling are the Icelandics, Norwegians, and the Japanese. And the Whaling Commission still exists as a consequence of these guys and their shenanigans in terms of trying to create some marketable product out of these animals that are, you know, noble and forgiving, if you want to take that gray whale experience.
Overall, would you consider kind of the threat to their numbers from, you know, this human hunting now kind of over, and that we're on the heel, and generally with the exception of those nations you mentioned, we're doing a good job at coexisting with them?
Well, I would say that we are not hunting them anymore. In terms of doing a good job, you know, these animals, the gray whales, are predictably accommodating, if not friendly, with us humans. But we don't, we're not as predictably good neighbors. There's a lot of other problems. Ship strikes happen, plastic load in the ocean, these animals are picking up that. And I think, you know, particularly with the gray whales and the humpback whales that have a coastal feeding part of their natural history, is that they get entangled in nets and in crab traps, lobster traps, and this is definitely, we just recently hired somebody to work with us who's also a whale disentanglement technician with the Marine Mammal Center out in Sausalito, and she says that, you know, 10% of the whales that they see out there have either entangled or signs of entanglement, that they've somehow released, the ropes and nets and what have you. So they may be not subject to our predation anymore, but they are subject to our industry, and that in kind of aside from the entanglement, the plastic loading, the toxics, the hypoxic zones in the water as a consequence of our runoff, they also are subject to the noise pollution of our industry, which is really one of the main things I'm focusing on.
Yeah, this might be a good time just to talk about you as the founding director of Ocean Conservation Research, and you can find that at OCR.org. I went there and found a wealth of information, including videos that are very informative. And, you know, you have so much knowledge both about acoustics and then how that translates into behavior and used by various animal forms and stuff. So tell us a bit about your organization and what your mission is there.
Yeah, thank you. I founded Ocean Conservation Research. I had been, since 1992, doing a lot of work on this issue of noise impacts on marine life, but not a lot was known. And finally, around 2000, I got together with some folks out here in West Marin, and we started an organization that was looking at this. And I was just doing it as an individual, and we started doing this as a public outreach and activist organization. And then I was getting hired by World Wildlife and Greenpeace and other organizations to write papers and attend meetings and speak. And I realized by 2007 that if I really wanted to drive the discussion the way I thought it was needed to be driven, I needed to actually do this full time. So I started this organization, Ocean Conservation Research, to really put our shoulder behind applying science and technology to try to improve the conservation efforts that we need to not just restore the habitat, but also, you know, attenuate our impacts. And so that's kind of what happened. Initially, the work was shunned by the U.S. Navy, who were one of the larger noisemakers and also one of the larger funders of science. But I think increasingly the Navy is realizing it's more cost-effective to do the right thing than to try to fend off bad public opinion. So in many cases, not at all, they're funding some good work, and they're still subject to overreach. I mean, the Navy is a big organization.
But so you've helped keep the Navy in check. You and your work and colleagues probably get credit for keeping the Navy from doing what they would otherwise do. Is that fair to say?
Well, you know, there is that. Right now, we are one of the plaintiffs on a case about the Hawaii Southern California testing and training range, where they basically indicated that they're going to compromise and take, if you will, some, you know, million animals, or level A take, which is, you know, that there's some kind of permanent physiological damage, and then quite a few more level B take, which is a habitat disruption. So, you know, NRDC is leading the charge on this, and we're basically plaintiffs in the case to try to get the Navy to roll down a little bit. Essentially, a few years ago, they released a five-year plan that included these numbers, and a lot of us commented on it. And when the National Marine Fisheries Service reviewed the comments and re-released what they call, not the draft, but the final environmental impact statement. It looked like they not only took what the Navy wanted to do, they dismissed pretty much everything we wanted to have included in the impact statement and gave the Navy just a little bit more. So it's a little overreach. So the Navy's not, you know, they don't have shiny stars on their chest right now. But you
and
know.
Your work's not done in that regard.
Yeah, we're working.
Michael, can you tell us a little bit about the deep sea floor oil and gas processing equipment that's expanding into the outer continental shelf and
yeah,
all the noise that results?
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. I mean, a lot of people, when I talk about noise in the ocean, the impacts of noise, everybody pretty much says Navy sonar. And while I say it is a problem, I think the larger problem is the impacts of oil and gas industry. And I think this is where this ties into the post-carbon theme, because one of the things that has allowed our carbon economy to occur is that these guys have been externalizing their costs, including the environmental costs. So in your introductory, you talked about cheap oil. In my opinion, oil has never been cheap, because it has always exacted huge costs environmentally, and because they've been so profitable, they've been also able to exact economic support from our tax dollars. And, you know, if you included, for example, the cost of defending the oil fields, for example, in Iraq and these other places where we've been toying around, it would bring us up to like $9 a gallon. But instead of paying at the pump, we pay, you know, our tax dollars pay for that. So I don't think oil and gas has ever been inexpensive. But increasingly now, to get at more difficult oil, they're going into deeper and deeper waters. And, you know, on land, when you pull oil and gas and stuff out of the, you know, out of the ground, it's up there, you can process it, you have stuff that doesn't necessarily qualify as marketable. I mean, an oil well doesn't just give off oil, it gives gas and brine and solids and sand and, you know, all these other things. So stuff all needs to be separated out into stuff that can be used and stuff that can't be used. And the stuff that can be used is typically reinjected back into the earth. The stuff that can be used is processed. And the challenge, though, is there's a lot of this material. And when you're going down 10,000 feet to get it to the bottom of the sea, bringing it up and then putting it back down again is really energy expensive. So what they're doing is they're building these huge processing plants on the bottom of the sea. And now when you're talking about the types of pressures, both in terms of the actual static pressure down at the bottom of the sea, but also the wellhead pressure. In the BP oil disaster, the wellhead pressure was 13,000 pounds per square inch. And this was blasting out oil and gas, brine, that they needed to separate. But, you know, when you talk about anything at 13,000 pounds per square inch, it's not a formula for quiet. I mean, a sandblaster, typical industrial sandblasters that are kicking out that roaring noise with sand in it, that's usually around 2,000 pounds per square inch. So it's noisy, and they're putting this in the bottom of the sea, all the other equipment down there. And then they have communications equipment that are basically communicating to the equipment, on a vessel servicing the equipment. They're not people down there. The static pressures are way too high for that. So you have all these bleeping and data chains and all this other stuff that's going on, and multinodal communications networks. You're creating essentially cities in the bottom of the sea. And I guess what we didn't say is, you know, the reason why this is problematic is it's dark down there, and most of the animals that are in that environment use sound to get around, much like humans use light. And as a consequence, when we're making huge noises down there, we're basically masking biologically significant noises.
Well, this is exciting that you're on this and helping us know that. I'm remembering back to when that BP was out of control and all we saw was visual images. Had we had microphones there, would we have heard a big noisy roar?
Pretty much. You know, aside from what was happening at the wellhead itself, all the processing that was going on to try to stop that, there were something like 24 tenders up above that were basically, you know, it's a lot of noise. There are pumps. There's a huge amount of equipment. And unlike, you know, noise in the air where you can kind of attenuate through surface features and trees and what have you, as well as the fact that air doesn't transmit sound as efficiently as sound is transmitted in the water. So all those noises travel, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles.
Yeah.
You can make a noise in the ocean that you can hear 2,000 miles away. And if you made a noise in Los Angeles that you could hear in Seattle, you'd have some explaining to do.
Well, you know, you bringing this up is so important because for most of us, it's been outside of our consciousness because we don't hear it. We're not down there with our ears hearing it. We aren't sort of exposed to how this is such a it's noise for all these other creatures in the sea, and that disruption of their lives, their habitat, as you said, that's something we don't really have much awareness of in our culture.
You know, we don't have awareness of it, and I've been going to a lot of these conferences, these offshore oil technologies conferences, tieback conferences, things like this, to try to get a bead on what the technologies are that are being used. And I've been sneaking around in my engineer drag. I have an engineering card from Pax Scientific when I was working with those guys, and they're pleased with the opportunity here. So, you know, I talk about flow patterns and pumps and different types of, just to get an idea of what the technologies are. And I got a call from a friend who used to work for ExxonMobil. Now he's working for an interesting organization that does contract scientific services in the ocean. And he said, you know, you don't need to sneak around. These guys don't have a clue. They have no idea this is problematic.
Yeah. Well, how about if we had microphones required at all of these undersea industries and then had that sound piped into the CEO's office or something?
Well, that's one idea. I like that. Let me try to get funding for that project.
Well, yeah, or even just the media having an awareness of this. I mean, it sounds to me like the need for people hearing what you are inviting us to understand here is huge.
Yeah, I mean, people think about certain things that are fairly simple to grasp. I mean, looking for oil and gas, they use these seismic air gun surveys. They're trolling these explosive devices that basically kick these pulses down into the water, kick it down to the substrate. They read the return, and they can determine where the oil and gas deposits are. And they monitor this, you know, not just to find it, but also while they're processing, while they're pulling it out, while they're doing exploration production. They continuously have these air guns. And you can hear these things, you know, 1,000 miles away. They're big booms. And, you know, it's really easy to see that that's not such a good idea. But, you know, in the larger scheme of things, because they're increasingly attenuating the higher frequencies, you know, when you get a few miles away or 10, 100 miles away, they may, and I'm only speculating this from a transmission model and what have you, those booms may sound like waves hitting the shore, you know, the same kind of energy, physical energy that would be transmitted. And so it's hard to, you know, you don't see animals floating up to the surface. You know, 30 years ago, they used to throw dynamite down and measure the return from that, and there would be animals definitely killed by that. But they're increasingly rolling off the high frequency part of it. And while I'm not going to say it's a good thing, it doesn't concern me as much as the other types of noises that may be generated off these other processes. So
because
I'm
these,
not focusing that much on that particular problem.
Because these other kind of industrial sounds would be continuous, and they're obviously going to be disruptive at whatever the radius is where it hasn't dissipated.
Right.
You know, but within that area, different species are effective by different frequencies and stuff, right? You talk about the whales communicating at a very low level, and if they can't do that communication, that screws up all of their, you know, family life, et cetera, right?
Well, here is one interesting element of that. You know, we typically mitigate noise exposures predicated on how loud something is. So all the mitigation guidelines that are put out by National Marine Fisheries Service are basically trying to keep the exposure noise level at a certain, you know, below a certain amount, because that affects the hearing of the animals. But what is not really looked at is, you know, what are the behavioral impacts of these noises. And a colleague of mine, Manolo Castellotti, and a few other folks who were recording the migration of fin whales in the Mediterranean saw migratory disruption that occurred as a consequence of air gun surveys. And the noise of the surveys were significantly lower than the noise of the ambient of the shipping noises in the Mediterranean. So it wasn't how loud it was the signal characteristics. And, you know, one of the speculations, I mean, you can't ask these big whales what they thought as easily as you can small dolphins, which you can use, you know, you could have closer relationships with. But these animals kick out pulses themselves, and their pulses are every 10 to 15 seconds, and they're loud, a low frequency. And this happens to be about the same period as the seismic air gun, every 10 to 15 seconds, a loud and a low frequency. So one of the speculations is these animals and their migration heard these noises and were somehow spooked by them.
Or confused by them, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it was quieter than the ambient noise of the shipping would indicate that noise level is not the key feature for the disruption.
It's really overlaying at the frequency or wavelengths that they're used to communicating in.
Right. And they might have heard, you know, they might have heard these things. And we don't know who they are, but they're bigger than we are. And they decided we're going to go down.
And the dolphins you mentioned, they operate at a much higher frequency, right?
Yeah, these are the adonices, the toothed whales, as opposed to the alien whales. The toothed whales, they typically hunt cooperatively in packs. They have high-speed hunting strategies. They eat larger animals. They actually capture them differently. The baleen whales, even though they eat fish and plankton and zooplankton and what have you, they capture schools. They don't capture individual animals.
So, it's like wolves versus bison, right?
Yeah, exactly. Same idea. And they to communicate at these high data rates. They use high-frequency sounds in terms of social vocalizations, but also in terms of their biosonar. So they're actually echolocating off these animals and creating essentially an auditory image of where they are. And it's all high frequencies, all between their biosonar vocalizations between, 15 kilohertz, in some cases all the way up to 180 kilohertz. And they can get very fine-pitched information about the animals that they're hunting.
So if like at the dolphins at that high pitch, if that frequency were overridden by some industrial use, it could affect their ability to be successfully communicate and hunt, right?
Yeah, if there's a masking problem with that. And there's not a lot of evidence right now that masking is the issue, but what I'm concerned about is that the signals that the dolphins are picking out are signals that they've adapted to. And they're used to hunting in large aggregations with a lot of other animals around them, echolocating. So they may be habituated to or evolved to or adapted to, high-frequency sound clutter. But the quality of the sounds that we're picking out, if you take some of the high-frequency communication signals and lower them down into a pitch that humans can hear, they sound horrible. They sound like those acoustic modems we used to have on our computers back when, that kind of raspy, nasty sound. And so that may be, in fact, more of a problem than the actual noise density. But it's a problem. I can guarantee you that much. It's a problem.
Michael, we're going to have to take a little break here. You're listening to KWMR Community Radio for West Marin, Point Reyes Station in Bolinas, 90.5 FM Point Reyes and 89.9 Bolinas, and streaming live at kwmr.org.
This is Post Carbon Radio with Bernie Steffen and Bing Gong, and today our guest is Michael Stocker of Lagunitas, who serves as a public spokesman on issues of ocean conservation, acoustics, communication technology, physics, and biology. He seems to understand it all.
And as we said in Michael's introduction, that Michael is a modern-day Renaissance man. He has many facets, and his avocation is a musician. And we have a little musical clip that Michael recorded and produced and plays bass.
Bass.
I'm sorry.
Bass.
Bass and percussion on it, and it's Courtney Brown, a vocalist, and the song is called Hollywood Lies. Here it is.
of a bride finally turned 18. We were magnetized to each other without knowing what that means. It was dispirited and dirty, but I was ready to rehearse all the love stories that I had written, that he would quickly sew the verse. And I can still clearly remember all the hope he helped me lose when he tore me into pieces, when he finally broke the news and said that he had discovered that love was just a Hollywood lie. He said we were born to watch our heroes fall before we saw them die. A liar and a thief, I was a sucker to it all. Used myself upon the shelf as I crawl into the fall, thinking that he loved me, and I surely loved him too. And this was what was supposed to happen, because this is what lovers do. And I can still clearly remember the night I got a different view of my lonely lover's face when he finally broke the news and said that he was gonna teach me that love was just a Hollywood lie. He said you were born to watch your heroes fall before you saw them die. And he put his t-shirt on, kissed goodbye and left the building. I heard his engine through the wall, but I couldn't summon the courage to grab the phone and make the call. But I can still clearly remember the blood as it trickled to my shoes, like my father's angry tears when I finally broke the news and said that I had discovered that love is just a Hollywood lie. Said I was born to watch my heroes fall before I saw them die. I said that I had discovered that love is just a Hollywood lie. Yes, I was born to watch my heroes fall. Before I finally turned 18, we were magnetized to each other, but we didn't know what that means. I can still clearly remember the night he told me, yeah, he broke me in two when he broke the news.
You've been listening to an album by Courtney Brown, that which was recorded and produced by Michael Stocker, and on which he plays bass and percussion. And Michael has written a new book called Here, Where We Are, which is an assembly of ideas and understandings of human and animal sound perception. Tell us, Michael, why you undertook this project of writing a book.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk about this. Many years ago, I was doing a lot of architectural acoustics and designing recording studios and museum facilities and exhibits and what have you. And I had a little slow period. I was trying to work on this idea that we are affected by the sound of our surroundings, but also how we sound in the surroundings. So it's kind of a phenomenological approach to sound experience and how it affects our surroundings and how we affect our surroundings with the sounds that we make. And I decided to kind of start writing an article about this so I could put it out to the museum museum industry. I did. The writing came pretty fast, and I was asked to write another article. You know, one thing led to the next, and in 3 days, I had like 50 pages, and wow, it's like a lot of information. So I realized that I should start writing a book. But in order to set the premise of the book, I needed to kind of clarify how sound is perceived and some of the both the natural history and the cultural history of sound and sound perception. And that ended up becoming the book that Here Where We Are. I really ended up getting a lot more into human and animal sound perception and the whole architectural element. Well, we had kind of those who have written books before understand that they behave like teenagers sometimes and they have arguments with themselves. I had to kind of split the two sections apart, and now the architectural bit is, you know, saved for whenever I have time later to write it. But this book came out. It's published by Springer, the scientific publishing house, but it's a trade book, so it's really written for a lay audience.
Well, I had a chance to read it here, Michael, and I'm impressed because I learned so much. I mean, you're packed with information, and you present it in a way that we can relate to, you know, the world and around us. You talk about this idea of we're in a soundscape and that there's a play between the silence and the noise, and that there really are different kinds of silence that comfort us and then different kinds of noise that irritate us. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, sound is a perception that we use to basically hear what's outside of our field of view and, you know, what is downwind from our sense of smell. And it is actually in constant, you know, vigilance in our perimeter because we'll be able to hear something sneak up on us. We'll be able to hear where safety, in terms of, you know, safety and abundance, all these cues, what, you know, water and caves. And they're all, you know, we hear them. And it's kind of on, not really in park, but it's kind of in the limbic system until something changes. And all of a sudden we're on full alert, voluntary nervous system kicks in, and we try to scope out what's going on. In a setting where, you know, like out in the country, we're not necessarily as alerted as often. But when we're in an urban setting or a city setting and we're inside a place where there's all kinds of little buzzes and clicks and it ends up setting us a little bit on edge, and even this, you know, the subtlest sound can interfere with our ability to communicate, our ability to understand where we are, and so it ends up essentially putting us under a little bit of stress, and sometimes a lot of stress, depending on how noisy something is. And I noticed this once I was a kid. I was sitting in my room talking to my brother, and I noticed that there was a real interesting variance between when it was like easy to communicate, our words flowed seamlessly, and then sometimes it would jam up. And I tried to correlate what that was. What turned out to be was there was a electric clock in the room that his cord was wrapped around the bed, you know, kind of the bedpost. And as I moved back and forth, it would pull the cord out, and the electric clock humming would go away. And when it went away, it was really easy to communicate. And when it came back, it created a noise between each of the words that we were all processing subconsciously. And it was only by me noticing that very subtle difference in electric clock buzzing and not buzzing and how it affected our ability to communicate that I realized how impacted even just subtle noises are. And, you know, one thing to the next, I'm not everybody is auditorily compelled, but, you know, maybe some of us are. Some people are very sensitive to the sounds around them, and they're constant set of, you know, mild anxiety, and other folks, it doesn't seem to bother them that much.
I'd like to invite our callers to join the conversation. You can call 415-663-8317 if you'd like to join us. And Michael, this book is dense, actually, because you cultivated over a lifetime of interdisciplinary thinking, incorporating your studies in world cultures, Western intellectual history, physics, architecture, biology, acoustics, signal processing, music, theology, and literature. It's amazing.
Okay. I'm a total information junkie.
Yeah, but the idea to relate it is what is so, that's why I want to recommend this book to everybody. And it's here where we are, and the here is H-E-A-R, of course. Here, where we are. And I learned so much, like I said. You know, and you were just talking about noise, you know, affecting some people and other people. In other words, we, with our brains, I guess, are able to adjust to what we consider safe noise or safe ambient background and ignore it and be still always alert, including in our sleep, to listen for new sounds.
Correct, yeah. And we habituate to things that we get used to it. But new sounds are always ones that will trigger us into a state of alert. And that's, you know, the thing that we know about sound, you know, something can sit there for millions of years and you can still see it. But for sound to happen, something has to occur. So we know that when we hear sound, our setting is in motion, it's dynamic. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's one of our kind of main alert systems. I spoke with my brother, who he's recently passed on, but he was a Vietnam veteran on what they call long-range reconnaissance patrol, essentially a sniper patrol. And he talked about this one engagement that he realized how much his eyes were influenced by his desire to believe and not. And he was basically, they were going down a trail, they would have somebody looking for tripwires, and they would have somebody watching to make sure that, not just somebody, like three people watching to make sure that there was no, you know, NDA coming down the trail or there was going to be a problem. And he said he was watching and there was a guy on the trail in front of him and he saw the six NDA coming down the trail in front of him and he just kind of synthesized it like it was okay until he said, wait, that's what I'm here to look for. He didn't want to believe it.
Yeah.
And so your eyes can be very deceptive. And people who are talking about eyewitness accounts of accidents and murders and any traumatic event particularly, they end up, they're being deceived. And there's a very low index of reliability in some eyewitness accounts. But ear witness accounts, interestingly enough, are able to track a lot more closely. People can match those things a lot better. And if they can say, well, I did hear this sound at some particular time, that might be a little better cue than I saw this guy in a red T-shirt running.
And we use the sound to help sort of orient us. And the other part of the ear that's about balance and our position in vertical in the three dimensions, those are very much related, right? In other words, we're not only listening for language and things to discern on whether an alarm or not, we're also just sort of listening that we're still connected to the living world.
Well, this is one of the kind of the kind of foundations of this idea of sound perception being a perception of localization, how we establish our relationship with our surroundings. And if you look back to the very earliest stirrings of life, you know, in the seventh week of gestation, human embryos align themselves with gravity. And they do so through the mechanism of the inner ear and the semicircular canals, which are in there. And it's not too much after that, it's like the 12th week of gestation, that human embryos, fetuses will respond to sound stimulus. And so second to touch, because they can respond to touch earlier than that, they end up responding to sound stimulus. And, you know, if you sing songs to your baby, you know, in the womb, those songs will be remembered by, and the voices of people around them, why a baby will be able to respond to a daddy's voice, you know, almost immediately after being born. And they imprint at an early age. And, this is only speculation, but it may be one of the reasons why some people are claustrophobic, because they may not have had the easiest ride in the womb, and they associate that kind of sound environment, closed sound environment, as something that might be unpredictable and not necessarily desirable.
Wow.
Vocalize that way, just in terms of the function of our ear, the physiological function. When we get out, that is connected to the outer world of sound through our eardrums. And, you know, there is a direct connection and vocalization cues where the ear and our thoughts of where we are reside.
And talking about the baby in the womb for a moment, and that's more of a sort of a water environment, and you talked before about how sound is actually transmitted more efficiently in a denser material like water rather than air. So correct. It must be pretty loud for that baby in there, hearing the heartbeat and the other functions of eating, etc.
Digestion and people outside. Yeah, I mean, there was a paper that I included in the book as a citation. You know, you're recording, and the noise levels are like 65 dBA.
Yeah.
65 dBA is it's like a loud restaurant. I mean, you can still have conversation in there, but it's noisy.
And then when the baby is born, then sound is one of those things that definitely they respond to right away, like the bell, like the alert, the alarm. They're very sensitive to loud noises once they're, you know, out of the womb.
That's correct. You know, babies are born with two innate fears. One is the fear of falling, so when they can see or sense that there's a drop, they'll recoil from that. And the fear of loud noises. And the other fear is that, you know, the fear of bad tasting things or lousy poetry or all that stuff. It takes us a while to learn.
Yeah, boy. And you know, the sound in our species versus sound in other species, I mean, we know about different ears, like deer having the ears that pivot and can hear better, and you talk about the ears have been specialized or evolved for whether you're being hunted or whether you're a hunter or both, and talk a little bit about that variety of ear types that exist.
Yeah, you know, the morphology or the kind of the way that ears are formed that really speak to what we need from our surroundings. And prey animals such as deer, horses, cats, small cats particularly, their ears can pivot. And, you know, a horse has something like 24 muscles that control his ear. A cat has 28 muscles, but they have some other things they do with their ear as well. Once they cock them down, they actually are learning to listen behind them when they're on frontal attack, so that they'll hear, that they can hear if anything's behind them, like speaking up on them when they're engaged in fight. But these periscopic ears that deer have, I mean, they can twist them different directions and they can kind of scan their horizon. Whereas predator ears, you know, dog ears, wolf ears, they face forward. And that means that they're focusing on their surroundings, and they're not really concerned with what's behind them because they've already kind of established that by moving through it. And human ears and a lot of primate ears are on the sides of our heads. They're kind of generalist ears. Well, they don't aim forward. They really, you know, scope the whole horizon. But we can, by virtue of the shape of that, the reason why we have these little whorls in our culture is that we can sound reflecting off of that very precisely helps us locate where sounds are coming from, even if they're coming from directly in front of us. So we have kind of generalist ears of both predators and prey, if you will.
Michael, tell us a little bit about how whales hear. They don't have external ears, do they?
No, they don't. And, you know, because of the hydrodynamics of the water, these animals are diving down, in some cases, thousands and thousands of feet. The water pressure, if they had an eardrum like we did, I don't know, you know, if you're a diver or a snorkeler, you know, you go down a couple of feet and you have to clear your ears and it's a lot of pressure on it. You know, our ears are sensitive to very minute pressure changes, so we're not really that well adapted to hearing of water. And if whales had that same problem, it wouldn't be a very successful adaptation to the surroundings. So they have different hearing mechanisms. In the case of the toothed whales, the odontocetes, we know pretty clearly now that they hear and transmit sounds through these fatty lipids, which are in their head. They hear sounds through these lipids in their jaws, which transmit the acoustical energy into detached otic capsules, where their ears, their hearing systems are located. And it kind of shakes those around. The baleen whales is a little more complicated. They do have auditory meatus, which is a transduction canal for sound, but they're typically full of wax. They don't have any external orifices that commutate to the outside world. So we know what their hearing capabilities are by doing modeling on their inner ear and their cochlea and the auditory bulla, but we still are very confused about how they actually hear, how the sound is conducted from the outside environment. But given that these animals are more sensitive to low-frequency sounds, the low-frequency sounds penetrate tissues a lot more, and maybe they have another tissue conduction system also through, I mean, I was involved in a necropsy in a gray whale many years ago, and this acoustic lipid, which is used as a conduction system, both in terms of transmitting sound as well as receiving sound of the abdominoceps, the gray whale has down the center of its rostrum the same fatty lipid, acoustic lipid. The challenge here is it does not terminate in what could be a clear pathway to the auditory bullet. It transmits into the front, this process in the front of the cranium. So we don't know quite how the great whales here, but the toothed whales, we have a pretty clear idea. But it's a little different enough. They don't have ears. You know, fish don't have ears in the same way either, but they hear, depending on the species, they can hear quite well.
But there are analogies to the terrestrial animals in terms of that evolution, right? You see that inner ear or something similar to it. At least you can draw some analogies between the aquatic and the terrestrial.
That's the best we can do. I mean, there are some people who are really doing some interesting work on this. Darlene Ketton at Woods Hole, I guess she's now at Curtin University, is doing a lot of work on the kind of the physiology of ear conduction, looking at the inner ears and modeling that. You know, but some of these, you know, we didn't know how these animals make sound until recently. I mean, and what kind of sounds they made. Now we're starting to see physiologically how the sounds can be made. We, you know, we think that animals need to push air through orifices in order for sound to happen, but they could be pushing liquids through these orifices. And there's an organ called monkey lips, which we see on pretty much all the whales, which is a very dense muscle structure that we now realize is used for these animals to make their sounds. By passing either liquids or gases, air through those, they can create this vibration, which then they transmit through various pathways through their skulls into the surrounding environment.
I saw a video you created, and you have it posted on OCR.org, that I don't know if it's alligator or crocodile, but they have two sets of ears, the part that is above the water for the air sound, and then they have a part that's in the water for listening for what's happening. And they have a very small brain for processing, but this ear system is quite sophisticated, right?
Yeah, it is, you know, and because they have their heads above water, and they need to hear what's going on there. But the ears that crocodiles and alligators have above water are very similar to bird ears, that they don't have the same, they have kind of a diaphragm system, without getting too deep into the physiology of it, but you know, they have these two ears that are placed on either side, fairly close, and they need to localize things in the you know, kind of air environment. But the jaws that are underwater, you would think that an alligator jaw had to be really robust and really rigid and tough. They actually are fairly thin, and they have these little lipid channels and these windows that really face to the outside, you know, in contact with the water, that are like diaphragms. And these could be early evolutionary adaptations that are like our eardrums, that they actually pick up vibrations from the water. And we see this similar type of thing in hippopotamus, where they have ears above water and also a lot of fatty lipids in their jaw, lower jaw system. We see a similar thing actually in elephants, when they have these very large ears, but they also have these fatty lipids which are in their feet. So elephants can hear through their feet, and they can hear sounds that are transmitted, you know, tens of kilometers away. So you can say that their feet are their ears in these cases.
Michael, I'd like to put another plug in for your book. It's called Hear Where We Are. Are you giving any book readings around the area?
I don't have anything set up right now. I left a book with Steve out at Point Reyes at the bookstore out here. But I haven't followed up on that, and maybe I could do something out there at some point in time in the near future. You know, promoting a book is a whole job in itself, and we just moved OCR into an office in San Rafael. I just have a new staff member today, and so we're kind of growing there. So I will be doing other stuff, but doing book tours. You know, the challenge with selling books nowadays, you could do a book event. And you might sell, like I did, a book event down at, not an open secret, but at, Book Passage. And, you know, it was nice when 30 people showed up, and I sold about 15 books, but you know, with what I make on each book. It's not a way to make a living, put it that way.
Right. And they can find out more on your website, the work that you're doing. And it is a nonprofit, and you'll gladly accept donations, right?
Definitely that. You're in fundraising stuff. The book itself, we have a website specific to the book if people are interested. It is herewherewear.com. And you can either buy it on that site or you can go through Amazon on that site. And, you know, if you buy it online, and I know who you are, I can write it because I mail the ones, not the Amazon ones, but for the ones that we mail out. And then the OCR.org, you know, there's a blog that we put out every couple of, 2 or 3 a month. I write something about ocean sound and sound perception or what have you. I've been doing it for years. I had no idea that one little topic could render, you know, 350 different blogs. But we keep them short so people don't have to wade through a lot of stuff. And we don't pitch anybody on that. We just, you know, try to put information out there.
I like the byline, human-generated noise about human-generated noise.
Thanks.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us on Post Carbon. We really appreciate the work you're doing.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. I really appreciate the guys, what you guys are doing as well in this post-carbon discussion. We have a lot of work to do.
Absolutely.
And if you or your friends want to listen to this show or any of our archive podcasts, you can go to wmpostcarbon.com. Now stay tuned for Cruisin' with Rick Clark.
Carbon radio, global warming has got to stop. We are getting things done way too slow, or else the snow will melt from the mountain tops. Hey, 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 we gotta be post-carbon. Yeah, 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 we gotta be post-carbon. Be post-carbon, yeah.